Well, hey, Casey, I can't thank you enough for spending some time with us this evening and talking to our audience and coming on our show. I feel so honored to be able to sit here and speak to you. And I'd love for you to just introduce yourself to our listeners.
First and foremost, thank you for allowing me to come on here, Ben. I appreciate it. My name is Casey Kang. I am a three-time cancer survivor of acute lymphoblastic leukemia and a stroke survivor. I am a trauma-informed cancer coach now, using somatic movement and breath work to help other survivors heal and reclaim their life and learn how to live healthier physically, mentally, and emotionally so they don't live in fear.
Awesome. I really appreciate that introduction. And I'd love to kind of just dive down a little bit into your cancer journey, if you don't mind, because you said you're a three-time survivor. And then now I just learned about the stroke part. And so I'd love to just dive into that because that stuff is very fascinating and interesting to me. And I would love for you to just kind of tell a little bit about your story.
Yeah, I'm going to give you the cliff notes because we can be here all night otherwise. But I was diagnosed with cancer February 14th, 2014. So on Valentine's Day. Yeah, I know. It's happy Valentine's Day. That honestly wasn't even the worst part. I mean, it's not great, trust me, but I was immediately hospitalized for treatment, and the treatment protocol that they originally put me on is 18 months long, and the induction phase is so brutal that you have to be hospitalized. So as soon as I got out of the hospital, I was still going back to the hospital about 3 or 4 days a week as an outpatient. And 4 months into my treatment, I had a stroke and seizures, which left me temporarily paralyzed on my left side. But I had not yet reached remission. So I was doing physical therapy and still receiving chemotherapy at the same time, while relearning how to walk and basically function as a human being again, on my own independently. And I did outpatient rehab for five days a week, 3 hours a day for 8 weeks. And again, still sometimes leaving rehab to go get chemotherapy, in the same day. So long story short, I finished my 18-month protocol. 7 weeks later, I relapsed the first time. And at this point, my oncology team said, your body's not responding to chemotherapy anymore. We have this immunotherapy or clinical trial. Well, one, if we did the immunotherapy, which was the less aggressive route at that time, it didn't negate me from the clinical trial. So I said, okay, immunotherapy, then clinical trials on the back burner. I tried the immunotherapy. It failed. It basically sent me into a cytokine release storm, which is where your body starts to kill itself from the inside out. Yeah, not fun. And so that was off the table. And so we're like, okay, stem cell transplant, or I'm sorry, clinical trial. There's a lot of testing for that. They test you for everything because they need a baseline for everything. And so even something as minuscule as like a lung capacity test is what they're testing you for, because they need to know where you're at and how the drug's going to interact with you, which takes months, by the way, to do all the testing because of the coordination factor. And so I'm in the hospital, and a week before I'm supposed to go on the clinical trial, it was shut down. And so I went to my oncology team. I said, now what? What am I supposed to do now? And they're like, well, we don't have anything. There's one other clinical trial at a different hospital. There's a wait list. And even if we put you on the wait list, which we're going to do, we can't guarantee you're qualifying for the trial. They have different parameters than ours and all yada, yada, yada. And I was like, this does not sound good, right? And with clinical trials, there's no line skipping. So it's not like, oh, you're sicker than the next person you get to skip. No. So I was like, this doesn't sound promising. And at that time, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society annual doctors conference had just ended. My oncologist came back and gave me 2 pages of research and said, do you want to try this immunotherapy? And I said, well, based on what just happened, I wasn't like super excited about it, because it was, yeah, right? Like, I would die from that one. Like, what makes me think I want to do this?
What else do I got to lose?
Right? And it was an immunotherapy, not even for my cancer. And it was 114 participants, 11 had the cancer that I had, and the outcomes were not good. And I was like, this is like, if they're offering this, this can't be good, right? Like, if this is what we're doing. And I make jokes because that's how I deal with very uncomfortable situations, as you can imagine.
That's fair. I'm right there with you. So,
and so after like, I don't know how many days of just thinking about it, I said, I'm going to do it. I go, because even if this kills me, which that's kind of the direction I'm headed in anyways, I'm like, maybe this will help somebody else. And so that's how I looked at it. And so 68 days in the hospital, I was like, can I go home? Because I need sleep. I need things. I want my bed. Like, I need to be breathing real air again. And so they were like, okay, we're going to let you out, but you have to come back as much as we ask you to. And I said, I will be back every day if you want me to. I just need sleep. Like, I just need my bed. And so they wrote a letter of compassion to the FDA and the drug manufacturer for compassionate care. And as I was leaving the hospital, they were like, you should settle your affairs. I was like, what? Okay. That's going to take a minute to process, but I hear you and I will do that. So while I was out, I spent time with friends and family and I planned my funeral. Spoiler alert to your audience, I got approved for the drug. Otherwise, this would be a very awkward conversation. 2 months later, they said, we got approval, and I did 4 rounds of isatuximab, which is another immunotherapy that is now FDA approved. And it got me into remission. So the goal was then a stem cell transplant. So back into the hospital I went, my brother is my donor, stem cell transplant. And I get out of the hospital again, and I'm recovering from all the graft versus host that's happening and just the physical nature of what had happened. And 6 months after that, I relapsed again. And they said, your cancer's back. And because I was being monitored so closely, they caught it really early. Like only 2% of it was found in my blood sample that they took. So they caught it really early. But at that moment, I was just like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I was physically exhausted still, mentally and emotionally. My head wasn't there, right? My head was on moving forward, and you're telling me I have to go right back to the beginning. And so I said, okay, what's the plan? And they were like, well, we need to get you back into remission and then do another stem cell transplant. And I was like, whew. I don't know if I can do this, right? Like, I really contemplated stopping. And I think I even said, like, I can't do this anymore. And my husband at the time was like, we'll decide, we'll do whatever you decide. And I said, okay. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the voice popped into my head, your dad would be so disappointed in you. And I was like, oh, of course he would, to get you this far and then just like quit. Like, that's just not okay. And just like a little fact about my dad's a high school basketball coach, still is. And, you know, I played sports my entire life, and like, that's like giving up at like, you know, the 5-yard line, just like going, yeah, we're not even going to try. We're not even going to try to get it in the end zone. Right. Like, you know, so that for me was like really the moment where I was like, okay, fine. Like, I got one more in me. I go, but this isn't for me. It's for the people who got me to this point, because I, quite frankly, don't care if I live or die at this point. I go, but they sure as hell do. And I go, but we're done. Like, we're not playing whack-a-mole the rest of my life. Like, you're either going to let me live or you're going to kill me. And there's no in between. And so we did another round, 4 rounds of the immunotherapy, and I've been in remission ever since.
That's really glad to hear after hearing everything you just poured out to us and told us.
Yeah, it's a lot. And you know, I can't change what had happened.
Yeah, and I'm listening to like the up and downs of everything, right? Because you like get the first diagnosis, which is, I can imagine, being horrible and scary, and then you feels like you reach this pinnacle of like basically getting through it. And you know, and even the first time you deal with that stroke, so on top of chemo, which already can wreak havoc on you, and you're tired, you have to go through physical therapy, which can also be fatiguing. And then you reach that point where like, oh, okay, you kind of reach this, I'm done. And then you get another, you go into remission again, you get another round of it. And then the third time's a charm. And so I'm curious, like each time, was there a goal that got you through each time and you just kept changing it, and kind of like how the goal line just kept moving? And I think it's interesting that you said the final time was like, I don't care if I die, I might live, I might die, but this one's about my family, about things like that. And so I'm just kind of curious, like your mindset.
Yeah. I mean, you're so focused on just mitigating the day and the problems that are right in front of you that you don't necessarily, or at least I didn't a whole lot, if at all, think about the long-term ramifications of what I was going through every day. It was literally the goal of the day was, I had a checklist, no joke, was get out of bed, shower, walk, and try and eat as best I could. And that was the goal every single day. And so if I accomplished those things, it didn't matter if I went to bed at like 3 or 4 in the afternoon, as long as I accomplished those, that was like, I'm good, right? Amongst all the appointments and all the other things. So I definitely set like everyday goals for myself, because otherwise, like, you're just like, then you have every excuse to pull up the covers over your head and go, 10 more minutes of sleep. Or what's the point of getting out of bed? Like, I don't have anything today. Or I don't have to get up until my doctor's appointment, so I'm just going to stay here, right? But that mentally, you can't do, because that could, you're never going to get out of bed. No one's going to force you to get out of bed. No one would have forced me to do any of the things that I was doing. It's like a hall pass. And it's like, I always just thought, is this going to make me feel better staying in bed? No, definitely didn't in the hospital. So why would it make me feel better here? And so even though I was in constant pain for basically like 5 years, I just said, do you think this is going to make you feel better? And I said, yes. So go do it. You're going to be in pain regardless. What's the difference, right? You're going to be in pain if you sit on the couch, or you're going to be in pain when you walk. But maybe walking is going to make you feel better. And 9 times out of 10, it did. So I always just like narrowed the focus, is what I like calling it. Because when you're looking to like 6 months ahead, like, that's not helpful to get you through that day.
I love how you just said you narrow the focus, right? And it sounds like you made a list of things you control. And I think that it's, you know, we as human beings, we need that control. It just really helps us. It's kind of like we need routines. And so that's really interesting that that's what you did. Like, I've never heard someone approach it that way. And so I love hearing it. And I think it's something that even someone that's not in those certain circumstances that you went through, everyday people need to hear that. Like, just a simple to-do list of 4 things you can control to get done. And so, yeah, I love you bringing that up. It's so interesting.
Yeah. I mean, you know, because you go through cancer, you don't have control over your time necessarily, because you have so many appointments you're trying to make it to or be at. You definitely don't have control over your bodily functions and what food decides to stay down your body or not, or any really, really bodily functions for that matter. And then to have a massive stroke and literally not have control over anything, and being like, even sitting up, I needed help to do. And so that really just made me go, well, what can I control? Because I can't control whether my body decides to sit up on its own or not, but I can keep trying and I can keep putting in the work, even if I'm just like, because there's just so much that you just, you don't have efficacy over.
Yeah. And that's an important thing to point out, right? Is that you go from this independent person to now, like you said, you have to have assistance to even stand up and sit up. And that a lot of people, especially people that haven't experienced that or even seen it, don't understand it. And yeah, so I appreciate you bringing that. I mean, that's a big factor to talk about, that, and it's a big mental shift too. I mean, and that's what people are dealing with that have like spinal cord injury, things like that. And so, you know, it's great that I think we're highlighting it and you're highlighting it and talking about it.
Yeah. And you know, it's the funny thing is, like, because I kept asking when I was in the rehab hospital, because they transfer you rather quickly out of the ICU and try and start you in rehab like immediately, pretty much. And I just kept going like, well, what are the odds of like full recovery? Because I was like, oh, how bad is this going to be for the rest of my life, basically? And they were like, we don't know. So they never told me that it wouldn't get better or would get better. They just kept saying, I don't know, which in my mind shifted to, it's possible to make 100% recovery. I never looked at it as like, I'm never going to be the same. I always thought, oh, 100% is possible, right? I just needed like a glimmer of hope to like shift that mind to go, just keep doing the work. Like, okay, I can do the work. I'm done hard. I'm doing hard. Like, what's the difference?
Yeah, and it just shows you how powerful your mind is when it comes to a circumstance like that, or even something similar. But like you said, you had that slimmer of hope and you held on to it and you're like, well, there's not a guarantee, but there's also not a guarantee that I won't get better. And so I'm going to get better. Let's do this. And then you just put one foot in front of the other.
Yeah.
And so going through your journey, I'm really kind of curious what, because you wrote a book, and I'd love to hear like what really started that idea to write that book.
So I didn't, it was kind of, okay. So it was kind of accidental in a way. I just knew that there was somebody out there who was struggling the way I did. So I came out of basically like 5 years of fighting cancer straight, like a 1 7-week period of nothing, but you're still not really doing nothing. And I came out after this and I felt a lot of shame and a lot of blame for what I had just went through, not only for myself, but for my family too. I was like, well, it's all your fault you got sick. Like, this is why this is happening in your life. Like, you know, and not only that, and mind you, I was in therapy most of my journey too. I also came out of treatment with every survivor that I had met before that for 5 years, basically saying, just wait till it's done. Everything's going to be okay. So then when I was done and I didn't feel okay, I was like, what's wrong with me? Right? Like, something's wrong with me that I'm not happy to be alive. And then everyone around me, especially family and friends, they're like, aren't you so happy to be done? And I was like, trust me, I was happy to be done, but I was so terrified of it coming back that I wasn't living. I was mentally in prison. Because I was like, well, I don't feel lucky to be alive. Like, I'm struggling every day. I'm overwhelmed. I have all this anxiety and fear over waking up and hearing that news again and, you know, all these things. And so for long story short, I had a nervous breakdown because of it. And I could handle the physical stuff and the hard stuff and the pain and all that, but mentally and emotionally, I didn't feel like I had the tools, even in therapy, to process and understand what I had just went through. And so that night that I had the nervous breakdown and finally admitted to everyone around me, I wasn't okay, which was crazy to even admit, because I literally throughout my entire treatment was like, I'm fine. And I felt fine. But in this moment, I was like, I would have rather died than lived that night. And that was really scary for me. And so that night, I just, while I was crying in front of my dad in a pillow, I went internal conversation again. I said, you're going to have to put your big girl pants on and figure it out, because you're not going to make it otherwise. And so I woke up the next day and I just put together this very imperfect plan. And I went to work. I was like, I can do work. I've been doing hard work. Like, that's okay. And I kept piecing things from things that didn't even really make sense. Like things from a lot of military survivors. I'm like, because it's very similar, even though the war is inside of us. I started piecing together like stuff from self-help books that really didn't like apply to cancer. But I was like, I don't know. See if this works, right? Talking to researching and talking to experts and just kind of like literally just throwing the widest net I could and seeing what came back. And I found through that journey, like there were some really prevalent questions that I was asking myself that really actually helped me move the needle to move forward and get out of that mindset of like, you're just afraid all the time and you're just scared and nothing's working, even though you're alive and you should feel good. And so the book kind of just came from a collaboration of everything that I did from all the different resources that I had experienced. And I just told it like a story. And I said, you know, this is the question that I asked. And this is why I'm asking you this question. And so it's kind of like an interactive book where you can literally journal out the question or answer the questions yourself as well. And it literally poured out of me. I couldn't type fast enough at times. I sat down every day and for hours would sit there and write. And then 6 months later, I had a book and I was like, whoa, I'm done. I have nothing else to say. And I was just like, I didn't even want to publish it or anything. I was just like, I just wrote it and I'm done and it's out of me and I can sleep again. My husband at the time was like, you should publish it. And I'm like, you should go to a publisher and publish it. And I'm like, no, because a publisher is going to censor everything that is inside the book because there's a lot of like inappropriate language and things that maybe aren't, you know, what a publisher would want someone to say, I guess. And I was like, I don't want to be silenced more than I already feel like I am. And he was like, well, then do it yourself. And I was like, okay. And I just decided to self-publish because I didn't want to be censored and I didn't want someone to tell me what I should be writing and shouldn't be writing. And, you know, this is my experience and this is what helped me and hopefully it helps somebody else. And the feedback that I got was that it does.
I mean, that just speaks to the power of authenticity, right? And then no one can help another cancer survivor than someone that's been through it before.
Right.
And so I think that's what's incredible. And I think that's why the work you're currently doing and got into is just slowly increasing. And you really did bring up an interesting point because it's something I never would have thought of is like getting therapy after surviving such a, you know, what you could consider a traumatic event. I mean, it's a life or death sentence that you've kind of just been given. And so if you would, I'd love for you to kind of expand upon that, especially someone that might be listening to this that maybe just got a cancer diagnosis or has survived it and they're looking for their next step or they're in that shoe where you said you were like, I'm not okay. And I finally had to admit
it. Yeah. On it, quite frankly, Ben, I think the minute you're diagnosed, there should be a therapist, number one, there with you while you're being diagnosed. Because the minute you hear the words cancer, it's like Muppets. You can't hear anything. You just block it out. You're like, what? Kind of. So you're already in a haze, but I think it should be an absolute must for anyone going through cancer because of the psychological ramifications of what you're dealing with. That's my personal opinion. But I found my therapist about a couple months before I finished, quote unquote, my first round of treatment. So it took a long time, a year and some months, because I was looking for someone specifically that dealt with cancer. And at the time, I did all of my treatment in Chicago, and there were only two at that time that dealt with cancer. And so I made an appointment with one of them, and she helped me a lot. But there were points in even our journey together, where I literally, we would argue and I'd say, "You don't understand what I'm going through." And she's like, "Yes, I do. I deal with this all the time." And I'm like, and she's like, "I've been dealing with it for years." And I'm like, "You don't understand." And then I just flat out asked her, I go, "Have you ever been through cancer?" And she's like, "No." And I said, "Then you don't understand." And she was like, "But I do." And I was like, "Oh my," and I got so mad that day. I'm not kidding, Ben. I walked out. I was like, "I'm done." I walked out. I'm like, "You don't understand," and left. I wrote her the meanest email because I wasn't in a good place anyway. So.
Understandably, yeah.
You know, and not the nicest things were coming out of me. And the next week I showed up again. And she looks at me and she goes, "I didn't think you were going to come back." And I go, "Listen, Wendy," I go, "we're going to agree to disagree, but I need help. And you're the only lifeline that I've got right now." And that was it. Like, I wish she wouldn't have said that, because she didn't understand. And I later, as we were completing our journey together, I asked her, I said, "So you said you haven't been through cancer." I'm like, "So what's your relation to it?" I'm like, because of our conversation from like a year ago. And she was like, "Oh, my brother passed away from it." And I said, which they're not really supposed to actually legally tell me that. But I was like, so curious that she just was like, "Okay, well, you're not going to be my patient anymore." And I was like, "Oh, so you don't actually understand." And I go, "Please don't tell anyone that you understand, because you don't." And I go, "Because you haven't been through it. You can't understand what it's like to be told you're going to die, like literally, not figuratively, literally, and then try and recover from that and have your body go through hell and back and say you understand." And so that was my opportunity to like really hopefully help her help others better. So ever since then, I'm still in therapy. I believe in it. I think it's necessary to have a safe space where you can go and dump all of your stuff on someone else that is not your friends and not your family, because that is not their job. That is not their job for you to dump that onto them. So I do it to somebody else.
That's her. I finally, I went to therapy a year ago, and so it was a very eye-opening experience, and I took some things away from it, but I do see there is a lot of benefits to it. I mean, and people don't understand how impactful the mind is on the body when it comes to more than just psychological stuff. I mean, you work in breath work and things like that, and so you understand like how the brain can affect the body when it comes to pain, which is part of what you do. And that's something where I'm actually getting educated in it now in one of my pain science classes. And it's just so fascinating. But yeah, I do agree that I think it would be, I see the reason behind having a therapist there for someone getting a diagnosis like that. But I think, will that ever happen? Probably not. But I could see, I'm going to bring up a book, actually. It's called Super Communicators. Ooh. And in there, there's a doctor.
It's a great book. It's a great book.
Oh man, I got halfway through it because I'm trying to be a better communicator on this podcast. And so the story about the prostate cancer doctor is like, just lines up with what we're talking about and how he approached the conversations differently. And I think that's something we're learning in our pain science classes. Really, you just meet the patient where they're at and to kind of understand it. And I don't want to crap on healthcare professionals, but there are some professions where it just seems like you're in such a time crunch versus like, as I get into physical therapy, I get more one-on-one with a patient than a doctor and things like that. And everybody has different experiences. And so I think maybe it, going back to the education process for the healthcare providers would probably be a way faster route, you know, to be able to have those conversations. Cause I mean, basically being told you're going to die is a big deal. Mm-hmm. And so having someone that can communicate a little bit better and like talk to you like that doctor did, you know, he changed the conversation.
Right. Right. And I think how we're told, how our diagnoses is told to us, it matters, right? Like, my doctors told me when I started treatment in the beginning, like, this is a 97% cure, right? The original chemotherapy plan, which is like, you're like, great. That the odds are amazing for me, right? Little did I know, like, I was going to get like the 1% that gets the stroke, the 3% that fall into, you know, relapsing and all of these things, you know, you don't know that in real time. So I think how they communicate the message and in the words that they communicate them with really do impact how we feel. Like because I work with so many that have been told these life altering news that, and it's when doctors look at you like you're going to die, that matters, right? Like we need someone that's like on our team that wants us to live just as much as we do. And I don't think doctors really understand or help that makes a difference for us mentally as well, right? We want teammates on our team that want us to be living the best, longest life we can, you know? And that's part of what you do as well as a physical therapist. You're like, I'm trying to make your life better. How can we do that? Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, I think it's lucky that our profession gets more one-on-one time, you know? And what's really interesting too is like, our profession has become a doctoral program so that we can get direct mm-hmm. access. Now, obviously I can't give you chemo and like tell you things like that, but like, you know, a physical therapist helped you after your stroke because you were in rehab. And so you can see a little bit of a different mentality there, but at healthcare as a whole, we're a team. And so, like you said, we're just a team and you want someone on your team. But.
And I mean, even in physical therapy, like it mattered what, how they like communicated their messages on like learning how to do basic human functions again. Like, you know, there was one very poignant story in my head that just popped out. Like I was sitting there and it was the lowest, most humbling moment of my stroke journey. And I was sitting on the edge of the bed and my husband at the time is putting my shoe on. I couldn't do it myself because I couldn't tie it. And he's tying it. And I go, can you teach me how to do that? And he was like, teach you what? Like he was very confused. And I started crying and I go, and I'm sobbing at this point. And I was like, this is really, and I think I said effed up, but used the word. I go, as I'm crying and I'm like, I'm 31 years old learning how to tie my shoe when I should be teaching a child how to tie a shoe. And my friends are teaching their children how to tie their shoes. And I'm learning how to do it for the first time because my brain literally couldn't wrap itself around the context of what he was doing, the loops and things. It was just all so complicated because your brain's affected by a stroke too. And I'm crying and he just goes, okay, I'll teach you. Like I went to I remember after he tried and it didn't go well because my brain wasn't accepting that information. I went to the physical therapist and I said, I just need to know how to tie my shoe. And she was like, what? And I said, because if I know how to use the loops and I could do that, that means I can use these fingers. That means I can put on a sock. That means I can put on a shoe. That means I can put on my own clothes. That means I have more independence. Like that's what she didn't realize was that the dot that connected was tying a shoe to getting better. And like, unless I would have told her that, she wouldn't have known that. But that, then she used that. She was like, well, if you want to learn how to do that, then you have to do this. And that's kind of like what guided a lot of our therapy then. And I did the same thing when I was outpatient with a therapist. And I said, I want to be able to do yoga again. Well, yoga is like two sides. My body doesn't work. And she goes, that's the goal. I go, that's the goal. She goes, okay, we're going to work on that. And that team that I worked with outpatient, they made it happen. Like by the time I was done, I was able to not do a lot of yoga, but I was able to do a lot of the poses that seemed impossible when I started. And so I think just even how you communicate, like, what are your goals? Like, and understanding what the context of why why the goal is, like, for you as a physical therapist, that means everything. If you can help me achieve that, like, I was able to do yoga. That's like, you gave me my life back.
Yeah. And that's an important thing you bring up. Cause I mean, that is like the bread and butter of our education is goal writing. And like, what is the patient's goal? What is the patient's goal? I mean, we literally just went through a case study about a patient that had chronic pain, like all over body. And it's like, what's his goal? What does he want to get back to doing? And he want to get back to playing with his grandkids. It's like, okay, so we have to discuss pain. And then because there's pain is so complex, you have to jump in and talk about, well, you have chronic low back pain. It's radiating down your legs. You have all this stuff going on. Maybe your nervous system's a little jacked up. Maybe we need to go through mindfulness and stuff like that. And I love that a lot of research has come back out and it just dives into mindfulness, breath work and stuff. So everything that you're doing like is coexisting in the education I'm getting. And it's just incredible the evolution of healthcare and other things that are starting to come out. And you see this interconnectedness of like activities like yoga and Tai Chi come in to help manage pain. Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. And like the connection between the body and because when I, and here's the thing, like when I was exercising, you don't feel pain. Those receptors for whatever reason, turn off. And I'm not a scientist. So I don't know why, but that's what I noticed every time I'd walk or every time I do yoga, that pain diminished greatly. And it's because your brain's not focusing on it. When you're sitting there on the couch, all your brain is doing is focusing on the one thing that's radiating, right? That's discomfort. It's focused on that versus like when you're doing stuff. And that's why like movement as the catalyst is a catalyst for change is a pillar of what I teach. Because when you're moving your brain, there's all these things that happen in your brain that subconsciously like things just shift and move and change. There's not a lot of pain when you're moving. Maybe afterward, but not during. You'd be surprised at what the human body can really do if it's pushed that way.
Yeah, one of my favorite things to say is movement is medicine. And I loved how you said movement is the catalyst. And I mean, it just coexists and aligns with like what we're talking about. And I really find that interesting that that's what you do with your clients is like one of the things you introduce is movement and you talk about its role it plays with pain management and things like that. And kind of goes into like the non-specific benefits of exercise, mm-hmm. You know, like the pain management, how it decreases your pain. But then I think it goes back to not control, but it shows you what you're capable mm-hmm. of. Right. And you have that control of like, well, you can modify everything. So now you're in control of how you can move. And like you said, it was going from learning to tie your shoe that affected other abilities and movement stuff that you could do. Then you get to this outpatient, your goal is yoga. And then you get to this yoga and then you just feel so much better. Right?
Yeah. It's all linked. Our minds and bodies are not separate things. Like they impact one another, right? Like even something as small as, well, it's not small for a lot of people, but anxiety, like you don't even realize you're not breathing. Like as soon as I tell people like, you're not breathing. And they're like, what do you mean I'm breathing? I'm like, I'm clearly alive. And I'm like, yeah, but if you're anxious right now, even in this moment, you're restricting your breath. I'm like, because that is what our body naturally does when it thinks it needs to be on alert. And that's what anxiety is. It's being on alert all the time. And I'm like, so you're not even breathing, which means your brain's not getting oxygen, which means you're not cognitively thinking properly. Like there's a lot to it. It's like, but people don't realize like how much they're controlling what they're controlling.
Yeah. Cause they hit that, their body goes in that fight or flight system. Mm-hmm. Right. And I mean, And that's understandable because, I mean, like you said, and you've been in that situation, I mean, you get that diagnosis and your body just goes, okay, I got to fight this. And so it kicks on. And so, like you said, the breath work kind of goes out the window and it's just hyper-focused on this. And so I think that's what's really great that you're teaching people to kind of come back from that. And that's really big.
Yeah.
And so I'd love to hear the evolution of like going from basically creating an incredible book to now that you're coaching clients. And I'd love to hear that evolution story.
Yeah. So I wrote the book and I was done and I was like, okay, I'm good. I wrote a book. Like, you know, I started sharing, like I wrote a book on social media, but really, because I was sharing so vulnerably about the struggle of like surviving and in such a way that no one had really been doing, clearly none of the survivors I had met either. People were like, well, women were reaching out to me and asking like, well, what did you do? Like, how did you do that? And I was like, manually, like through Instagram, typing away. And then I like, it dawned on me. I'm like, this isn't very efficient. Number one. And number two, like, I think there's something here. Like, I think I can actually help people. And then like, I got an email address and then I just like started manually doing all these things. And I was like, there's gotta be a better system. Because me manually sending out all the things, like, that's not efficient. So then I just, like, kept, like, then I built out the course and that has movement and the mindset pieces all in one. And so I just, like, well, I developed this and here you go. If you want to work with me, here are the options. And I have a free community, a paid community, the program, one-on-one. And now it's, like, the foundation's there. And so it's like, which one's right for you? And let's find that. And let's go. Let's get you better.
It's so wonderful to see the power of social media used in an incredible way like that.
Yeah. You know?
Just kind of like how I randomly just found you on Instagram and sent you a message of, hey, let's chat.
And I was like, okay. Why not? Right? Like that, it's supposed to be for connection. Even though so many people feel disconnected from it and feel more disconnected because of it, if we use it the way it's intended, it doesn't have to feel that way.
Yeah. And that's a big thing I think a lot of people are fighting back against and trying to educate people on is like, use it as a tool, not like a lifeline, which a lot of people, I mean, and you get, and you can go into the science of it, but like you said, if you use it like it's meant to be, it's actually a great thing. And as you can see, you've gotten clients, we've connected, and there's so much more. And you also get to spread your message to a larger audience, which is exactly what I'm kind of trying to do with this platform. And so that way you guys can come on here and share your stories and get more reach. Yeah. It's all about you guys. Yeah.
It's humans helping humans, right? Like that's all we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah. And I love that you were talking that you brought up a community, because I think that's what a lot of people are looking for is a community. I know that, you know, speaking to some of the adaptive people I've talked to, that was one of their big things was like, I found a second family. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we all need. Cause like humans, we love connection. I mean, we saw what happened during COVID. People were like locked in their houses and they weren't connected. And if, you know, you're a single person living in your apartment for 2 years, that's rough. Yeah,
or even with one other person, it's rough.
That's fair. Casey, thank you so much for your time this evening. It's been a blessing just to talk to you, and I love that we just nerded out about breath work and pain and talking about movement. Like, it was incredible, and thank you so much for all that you're doing and being open and vulnerable and sharing your story. And I can't wait to watch everything come together and continue to see the amazing work you're doing.
Well, thank you so much, Ben, for having me. And I trust me, you're going to be such a great physical therapist because of just even what you're doing and the way you communicate. And it's a big deal. It matters. And thank you. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate those kind words. And so people, I take it, can follow you on Instagram and if they need it, your book is also on Amazon, correct?
Yes. So you can follow me on Instagram at The Happier Hustle. And if you listen, like reach out, say hello. I, you know, I answer every question basically that's asked to me if I can. If I don't know the answer, I say that. and yeah, you can buy my book, Finding Your Way Back to Heart Center, Cancer Treatment Ended, Now What, on Amazon.